statistical framework. And I think what the witnesses, what I'm trying to give you is some of our experience.
Well, I guess, and let me, and maybe it's not true, and I don't have the source of the information, and if I'm incorrect, I'd like to be corrected. But that since statehood, that there have been 12 or 13 verdicts of $1 million or more in the state of Oregon. And I'm talking about verdicts. I'm not talking about settlements. And I would think that verdicts should be a lot easier to get information on than settlements. And is that an unreasonable request? And I throw it out because I keep asking people. No one can tell me. And I get you give me national statistics. That's good. But I want to know what's happening in Oregon. If we can get national statistics, I don't know why we can't get for verdicts, not settlements. I understand the problem that you have there, but verdicts, that should not be that difficult, I would think.
I'll try.
We'll do the best we can, Senator. We have to turn to the courts in part for that. I've seen some studies on some counties over certain limited periods of time. But that, I think, has involved going into the files within those counties and, quite frankly, just extracting from those files reports of the verdicts out of the particular cases. I think Senator Hamby had requested earlier a report from Washington County, and they took about a 3-year period there. I think Legislative Research had done that, and they brought some figures out of those files. On a county by county basis, selected period of time, you may find those figures. We'll do our best to see what we can come up with for the state of Oregon. I think the only comment I'd like to make, however, in terms, and I certainly appreciate your frustration and having served with you on a committee that asked these kinds of questions and looked for these kinds of figures. I, too, was frustrated frequently in the fact that we often just did not have at least the statistical analyses, the statistical bases to back up what we wanted to do. But I would say this, standing back and looking at the big picture. You say, why should we move now rather than wait and see what other states are doing? Well, 10 years ago, 1977, when it was my first term in the legislature and we were looking at a number of tort reform issues even then, had Oregon made a lot of changes, we would have been at the forefront of the changes in this country. Oregon is no longer and no longer would be at the forefront in making these changes. And I think that when, if you want to look at it from an economic development or business standpoint, businesses looking from the outside, looking in at Oregon, if we resist making changes in tort reform, I think it becomes an economic development issue, and I think people would be discouraged in looking at this state if we alone, say, in the West, didn't seriously address the issue of tort reform.
Senator Cohen.
I guess I want to respond or reframe this whole issue, and John, you mentioned that legislature made changes on strict liability and redefining the terms, if you will, along the way, and I think that's true. We didn't really consider the economic impact or didn't have the information. I think that's where I'm confused with this whole issue. I think the collateral source issues and the joint and several issues are matters of equity and redistribution of what is finally sort of the damages or the payment of the damages, and that, in fact, that's, you know, for anybody to sit here and think that we're going to have major, we can make economic justifications for changes in either of those. I mean, within my own limited knowledge of having been here since 1979, worked with KIPP on committees like this, I don't see that those areas are going to bring us much in the way of impacts on cost reduction. If we want to talk about whether we want to change the equities for the business climate, that's another issue, and I think we ought to really be straightforward about it instead of trying to sort of pretend to the public that you're going to have some miracle reduction in the rates, and then all of a sudden, yes, we go into a dip, and then it'll come back up again, and whatever the natural cycle. I'd just rather have the whole issues debated on the merits of the equities and whether we ought to take a real redistribution of those or not. And so for people who talk to me and for people who testify, I need to have, as we go along for any additional testimony, I need to have some of those arguments put on the table for me, because I'm going to be looking at them for what I think they are.
Senator, I don't want, and I think I've emphasized this before, I don't want to mislead you or anybody on this committee that I or anybody who appears before you is going to be able to sit here and say that this will result in a lowering of insurance rates. It would be darn reckless for us to say, as well as for you to go back and tell your constituents, look what I did, it's going to result in a lowering of your insurance rates. I think we are looking, hopefully, at introducing some stability and maybe some predictability to the whole system, trying maybe looking at more of a leveling out. The chair has talked numerous times, and certainly the evidence is there about the peaks and valleys, and that maybe we are on the downside of a particular cycle at this time. I think what we're looking at in terms of a number of these reforms is trying to level out that cycle so that it isn't so extreme. That's why I allude to the example of the California MICRA Act and the limitation on damages on medical malpractice. Sure, they experienced an increase in medical malpractice and premiums. It just wasn't as bad as it was here or elsewhere in the country. I won't tell you that we're going to end up with less insurance rates. I'm afraid the way our society's going, we're going to, whether slowly or rapidly, always have increases.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. I think I will. Okay. I'm going to skip on the agenda down to the sections 21 through 23, directors' liability and nonprofit corporations, because there are some people from out of Salem here to testify. And besides, I think we need a kind of a change in our thinking here.
At some point, Mr. Chair, will we be able, before the end of the session, to come back to Mr. Hamlin?
Let's see now.
On joint and several.
Well, yes, we're not going to eliminate that, and I'd like to get to him today, so I won't have to come back.
I'll keep my mouth shut. I can come back at a later time.
But let's go down here to sections 21 to 23, and Sally, come on up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sally Goodwin. I represent the Oregon Association of Homes for the Aging. Our association wishes to express our support for Section 23 of Senate Bill 323, which limits the personal liability of volunteers who serve on a nonprofit organization's board of directors. Our membership consists of 67 such nonprofit facilities, which provide housing, nursing care, and services to 10,000 older Oregonians. These homes are sponsored by churches, labor unions, and fraternal organizations. All of them rely on a volunteer board of directors serving without compensation to provide them with the necessary link to the communities which they serve. Unfortunately, our homes have not escaped the major increase in insurance rates any more than anyone else. Rates for general liability, umbrella liability, and for director and officer policies have all skyrocketed. Our focus today, of course, is director and officers' liability insurance. In some cases, not only has there been a dramatic increase in the rates, but such insurance coverage has been absolutely unattainable. As a result, this last year, at Olive Plaza, a facility we have in Eugene, 7 out of 13 of their board of directors resigned because that facility was temporarily without coverage. We believe that individuals who serve as volunteers on these boards give freely of their time and talent. It seems unfair that in doing so, they should be jeopardizing their personal assets. We requested a synopsis of DNO claims from Karun and Black of Oregon. While I need to point out that these claims are certainly not exclusive in Oregon, nor are they all-inclusive, I think they are representative of the type of claims for which DNO insurance pays. We categorize them into several broad categories, and I am not going to read the examples, but there is one listed specifically for each type. Just briefly, corporate takeover or merger, there were 19 claims paid. Bank or savings and loan, 5 claims. Commerce, 11 claims. Stockholders, 12. And in securities, 5. However, from our research, we have located few, if any, cases where DNO insurance has actually paid a claim related to the performance of a nonprofit corporation board of directors. And I want to mention there, I talked to Karun and Black, who is one of the largest insurance companies in the state. They went back 10 years in their claims department. There has never been a claim paid for a nonprofit board of directors on director and officers' liability insurance. However, the fact that this is a type of insurance that is not being utilized does not mean that we have not had major, major increases. And I'm listing there 5 facilities and the increases in premium coverage between 1985 and 1986. Calroga Terrace in Portland saw premiums go from $1,405 to $5,622. At the same time, the coverage they were purchasing declined from $3 million to $1 million. Willamette View Manor in Milwaukee saw their premiums go from $2,490 for $5 million worth of coverage to $10,209 for $1 million. Olive Plaza was the most dramatic increase, with premiums going from $237 for $5 million to $3,737 for $1 million worth of coverage. We believe that Section 23 of Senate Bill 323, if it was adopted in its current form, would greatly reduce the need for nonprofit facilities to carry director and officers' liability insurance. According to the proposed bill, beyond the coverage of an optional insurance policy, there would be no liability for director and officers unless it was gross negligence resulting in personal injury or death. To the best of our knowledge, all current DNO policies have a specific exclusion on that sort of damages anyway. Consequently, if this bill was passed, little would be gained for a facility to cover DNO or to have DNO coverage. Consequently, it would be possible for individuals to continue to serve in volunteer roles without jeopardizing their personal assets, even in the absence of a director and officer's policy. We'd like to point out that if Section 23 was adopted, the recourse to the plaintiff against the entity would remain unaffected. It's only the personal liability that would be removed. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to respond to them.
Well, I really want to point the committee members' attention to the statement on page 2, beginning from our research, we have located few, if any, cases where DNO insurance has actually paid a claim related to performance and so on and so forth. I think that that's the most telling point in your testimony. I've heard it time and time again. You've got no bad claims experience, and you still can't find insurance that's affordable. Now, that's a pretty sad commentary on the system, in my view. And so, you know, obviously, the form of the civil justice system didn't have too much to do, I guess, with the fact that your insurance was either unavailable or had a high cost because you didn't have any claims.
I think one of the things that happens, Senator, is that when you talk about director and officers' liability insurance, there's a tendency to include proprietary as well as nonprofit corporations in that. And when ratings are done, I suspect, and I'm making an assumption, that it's based on losses for corporations as well as not-for-profit corporations.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We'll move to, John DeMay. And Inez Campbell's here. Is Inez Campbell here? right. Inez Campbell of the Benton County Council of Social Agencies is not here. Susie Rademacher from Corvallis, is she here? All right. That'll help me kind of plan this order of witnesses. And go ahead, sir.
I'm John DeMay, Executive Director of Rainbow Family Services. We're a McMinnville-based nonprofit. With me today is Jeb Bledin, who's president of our volunteer board of directors. We operate a residential youth treatment center, and we're under contract to CSD for the treatment of adjudicated youth. Today we're here representing the Oregon Association of Residential Youth Care Centers, and that is about 20 other very similar organizations around Oregon, all dealing with adjudicated youth, all of whom are wards of the state. Just as a little background, since the legislature met 2 years ago, the nature of our business has changed a bit as a function of the decision that we took here to reduce the size of our training schools. We're seeing a qualitative change in the sort of youngster who comes into our centers for treatment. And they're more disturbed. They're requiring more monitoring, both from the point of view of, well, safety of staff, other residents, and protection of the community. I think more and more of us are getting training in how to physically handle youngsters. There was a time when if a youngster didn't want to stay around, you just let him go out the door. But that time is long gone. And we have seen a marked change in the 2 years past. By and large, I'm just here to tell you that the situation is really dire as far as we're concerned. We're talking now about 320 youngsters in the state who are treated for about 6 months apiece as a function of our CSD contract. They're all wards of the state. Some come from McLaren to us. Some go to us instead of McLaren.
Senator Cohen.
I serve on the board of Parrot Creek Ranch, and I just want to say that I think I'd ask you to talk about your increases in officers and directors' liability insurance rather than problems you're having with kids right now, because I'm not sure that wouldn't argue for the fact that you need better and,
yes,
and different sort of coverage, and maybe you ought not to be exempted. But I know that Parrot Creek's gone from $1,800 to $24,000 in August, if we can get it. I'm interested in your specific figures.
Well, we don't have any because it's way out of our ballpark. And
so you've been priced. Your officers and directors do no longer have a coverage then.
And I think most of the members of our association have none at this point. And it's beyond that because as of 87, there's no one in Oregon, no one insuring in Oregon that we know of. Our policies don't expire all at one time. Thus far in 87, two of our centers have come up for renewal. All the insurers in Oregon now are making exclusions for anything having to, any claims arising out of physical or sexual abuse of youngsters and transmission of AIDS.
Let's just talk about for now the officers and directors piece. Are you then suggesting that we talk about that we deal with the officers and directors, or are you suggesting that for the other portion of all of this, that the state take on the liability since they're primarily the state's clients? I mean, I need to know from you what you're advocating here, because I think you're talking about two different things.
What I'm advocating today is, as I understand it, directors and officers insurance is for a specific set of allegations.
So it covers only the volunteer directors and officers.
Well, it covers officers and directors, but only for a specific set of allegations. The lady preceding mentioned those. They have to do with, you know, discrimination in employment, fiscal mismanagement, et cetera. But that doesn't mean that your directors, your volunteer director, is not personally liable at this point in time for that exclusion that I just mentioned. That is, if you have a staff member who abuses a youngster, or a youngster runs away from your center, gets abused, and somebody alleges that you shouldn't have let him run away, and you let him run away because, and they can bring a chain back up to the director, he's liable for that. And our policies currently cover our directors for professional and general liability. They do indemnify our directors. But when you find an exclusion like this smack dab in the middle of your general liability policy, your directors are wide open. See, we've been able to live with the, with the absence of D&O insurance.
I am concerned that Section 23, as drafted in the bill, is not going to do what you think you need to have done. And we need to talk a little more thoroughly about that, Mr. Chairman, somewhere along the way.
Help me. I thought it did. I thought it was all liability arising out of that position as a volunteer director. Counsel, what's the committee understanding?
My understanding of the section is that it is to essentially eliminate liability of directors for their negligent acts. That is, for them to be liable in the first place, the plaintiff would have to show that they were negligent in carrying out their duties, and that your problem has been that you can't get insurance to cover that situation. And I guess the conversation that you and Senator Cohen need to have is whether that is the extent of the problem, or whether you have liability insurance problems beyond that issue. That's what I understand.
Yes, I want you to think about that and come back another day, and we'll deal with it and come to my office or whatever, because I think that's another issue there, which goes beyond the officers and directors.
Okay, thank you.
This is something else we didn't get in the task force from the insurance industry, and that is, again, especially with child care centers, why a California case would result in the practical elimination of insurance availability in Oregon for daycare centers and so forth. And I didn't hear during all these months on the task force, and I certainly would love to hear from the insurance industry. The insurance industry ought to come in here and put on the record for the people of the state of Oregon why it is the daycare centers can't get coverage, or it's sky high, when there hasn't been any claims history that justifies it. I mean, that's what I want to hear them explain. And I don't think they're ever going to explain it, frankly. Now, what I'd like to see also is an editorial, Jeb, occasionally, that asks the same question about why are these companies charging these rates, or where are these companies? And I don't know, maybe you've already put something in the paper, but I mean, I'd like to see some more editorial comment. Maybe your being here today will create some interest in you to look at this thing from the point of view of let's make a demand for some explanation from these insurance providers as to how can they justify this kind of thing that's going on.
Is there a section of this that talks about setting rates on Oregon experience?
That's part of the package that we've got in this committee, and believe me, we'll give that a lot of attention. But anyway, there's any other questions? Okay. Jeb, do you have anything else?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I could make just a brief comment. Mr. Chairman, my name is Jeb Ledeen. I'm, as John stated, president of Rainbow Lodge, have been for about 5 years. It is my opinion that Senator Cohen is correct in that we do advocate other things. We feel, for example, that child care centers specifically like ours and like she may be associated with ought to be under the same kinds of limitations as the state of Oregon in terms of its liability limits. That's another issue, though, and probably will be dealt with elsewhere. But perhaps, in fact, it's my opinion that Section 23 of this bill probably shouldn't be in this bill. It ought to be someplace else under something dealing with nonprofit corporations, because this is not an issue of premiums as much as an issue of who is going to direct the business of these nonprofit corporations. The fact of the matter is that even though there are no claims that have been held against directors, it's only going to take one of with any publicity at all, and we're all going to be headed for the doors. I know that I personally, if I start to feel that there is any more risk than there is right now, and this whole feeling is starting to grow, that I could not sacrifice our business or put it at risk to be on a board that has the kind of risk that a child care center has. And unless there can be some kind of limit to the liabilities of board directors, I think that they will just be leaving that service. And in fact, in situations like ours, these are duties that really are the state's duties. We're taking care of the wards of the state, and the state has chosen to perform that duty through nonprofit corporations because it's frankly, more economic for the state to do it that way. So the nonprofit corporations come in and the volunteer boards, and yet we do not have the protection that the rest of the people in the state government have who are performing these duties under the real umbrella of state government. So if it were possible, I'd love to see something like this taken out of this bill, which is a real tough bill, and you're dealing with a lot of different emotional issues on limiting liability and how, whether it will affect premiums. This particular aspect is something I think that ought to be dealt with separately as regards to nonprofit corporations in the state. So I just wanted to come here with John to represent some of the people that are out there that are very concerned about this issue and how it might impact their ability to continue serving on these kinds of organizations.
Mr. Chairman?
Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Senator Brenneman?
Question. Would either one of you, you know, in the thing, Mr. DeMay, that you passed out here, it says in the next to last paragraph, to quote from it, your ability to insure yourselves and board is becoming even more limited. At the current time, we know of no insurers operating in Oregon who will cover our centers without major exclusions. What are either one of your opinions as to why that situation is occurring? Your view.
Well, I've seen some statistics from the last insurance company, the one that many of us have today, and nationwide, their loss experience is not good. Their losses have exceeded premiums for the last 2 to 3 years. So they're just looking to cut their losses. You know, some of their losses must have occurred in this area, that is, in physical or sexual abuse sort of allegations. I think they just carved it out of their policies to make their loss ratio look better.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? All right. Thanks again, gentlemen. Let's see now. We've got. I'll ask again if Inez Campbell is present or Susie Rademacher. All right. We've got. Kip, did you want to testify on this? Your name's been inked in here. I didn't know whether you wanted to.
I'm supportive of it.
Okay. All right. Charles Burt.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Charles Burt. I'm an attorney from Salem. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I want to briefly step out of context. I was here during Mr. Holmes' testimony, and a couple of things I think deserve an answer that, and if you will bear with me, if I can go back long enough to answer them. It's on another section.
Yeah, I understand. Go ahead. I think you're entitled.
First of all, what I said about the state of Washington was that even when they came before the legislature and said these reforms will reduce premiums, that was their testimony. The premiums have been increased since the reform went through, as reflected by the insurance commissioner's article. That's what I meant by it being a failure. It didn't do what they said it would do there. It has not done that in any other state. California, the statistics are in your file, has the highest premium for OBGY, anesthesiologists, and neurosurgeons in the United States. So if they're the leader in this progressive movement, while they may not have gone up as many percentage points as they had, they are still the highest, and far higher than Oregon. So I call that to your attention. Number two, Justice Peterson would be the very person who would be the most able to know about jury verdicts, not only from his defense experience, but bear in mind his court and the Court of Appeals, which he supervises, and the trial courts, which he supervises, handle every one of these cases. And he's most knowledgeable. He's probably one of the few men who would be knowledgeable of all of what's going on in our state. Senator Hill has left, but someone, and I will send him a copy of this, there is a publication put out every 2 weeks of every jury verdict in every county in the state of Oregon and in the state of Washington. It gives the amount of the verdict. It gives defense verdicts, plaintiff's verdicts, and settlements in court. It's been published for years. I'm very confident that that company would send him all the back issues, and there'd be no question. I think he will see that in the state of Oregon, the value and number of plaintiff's verdicts has consistently gone down. I will take it upon myself to send him a copy of that. One final thing, and I'll get clear off of this. Senator Cohen's question about what we can do brings this to my mind. Mr. Holmes' office, with 13 lawyers and 30 support people, is not overstaffed. We're charged to give good services, and it takes about at least two support people per lawyer to give top quality service. That adds to our overhead, which is our overhead runs around 50% of our total income, which is about right nationwide. It's competitive. But what I don't think we are dealing with is this. In 1980, when I was president of the state bar, there was 4,400 lawyers. In 1987, there are 9,200. And the prediction is very clear. By the year 1990, there will be 12,000 in a state where the population has actually gone down by around 150,000. We, as members of the bar, cannot control admissions to the practice. I'm afraid that under the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling, you, as legislators, cannot.